You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
And as announced in the topic of the event, will also be a survey of the 50 years of the U.S.-Russian relations. We have a distinguished panel. It's the author of this report, Deputy Director of the Russian Eurasian Program of the Carnegie Endowment in Washington, D.C. We're lucky to have Matt Rosatz. He has firsthand knowledge of how Russian-American relations are perceived from the other side of the Atlantic, and in particular on the Capitol Hill, right? That he will be able to share with us. We have with us Ambassador Eduard Malayan, who has worked in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Soviet Union and the Russian Federation for many years, and now serves as the Executive Secretary of the U.S.-Russian Bilateral Presidential Commission. We're also expecting to have with us tonight, we're waiting for Eric Rubin, Deputy Chief of Mission of the U.S. Embassy in Russia. He has probably been trapped in one of Moscow's notorious Propkas traffic jams. This report is quite unique. While other publications that come out that are dedicated to Russian-American relations tend to focus on policies and problems, this report focuses on institutions. We will have Matt speak about the report for some 15 minutes, and then Ambassador Malayan will
few comments.
We'll speak for 5-7 minutes. Afterwards, we'll open the floor for questions and answers. That will take another 30 minutes probably, and followed by 30 minutes that we'll dedicate to commentaries. It will be concluded by closing remarks by our speakers. So, Matt, now I give the floor to you, please.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Natalia. I'm obviously, я всегда рад быть здесь, в Москве. Я извиняюсь за то, что я буду выступать по-английски, чтобы я могу как бы более эффективно и более тонко объяснить мой доклад. Но я просто хотел благодарить моих коллегах здесь, в Москве, и особенно посла Малаяна и Эрик Рубин за то, что они согласились быть с нами.
So,
hey,
good to see you.
So I think I'll continue in English, and I'm a little bit uncomfortable talking about the 50-year history of the U.S.-Russia relationship when I think on either side of me I probably have at least 50 years added together of experience in managing the U.S.-Russia relationship. So I think I will probably be brief on the history, and I'll focus more about what this report is mostly about, which is the new bilateral presidential commission. And Natalia is right when she says that, as far as I know, this is the only report, and this is certainly was my intention, that focuses on how, not what, not why, but how. How, for 50 years, and how today, do we manage this extremely complicated, extremely difficult, at times extremely painful, but clearly nonetheless very important relationship. Because really at the end of the day, if we don't have the tools and if we don't have the relationships in place, it doesn't matter what we want to do. We're not going to get it done. Now, we've been doing this for some time. Obviously, the United States and the Soviet Union were allies during World War II. We know that this was a defining event for both countries. Certainly, it was for the Soviet Union, and I believe it was also for the United States. It created the impression of both countries as the indispensable nations in the world, and it also ushered in the Cold War rivalry. And yet, It's striking that in the immediate decade following World War II, there was practically no direct U.S.-Soviet cooperation. It was not really until 1958, with the so-called Lacey-Zarubin Agreement, that direct working-level cooperation between the United States and the Soviet Union began. That agreement ushered in essentially annual exchanges of students and scholars and researchers on the order of 75 to 100 per year. That was later increased into the 1970s and 80s, and the agreement basically endured throughout the Cold War period, although it was superseded in many respects by other exchanges that occurred later. But this was really the first step where people on a working level actually began to get to know each other, to learn together, to try and do research together. So very, very minimal, a very first step. In the 1970s, there was sort of a new trend with détente, came what I call summit diplomacy, the idea of advancing the relationship through a broad agenda in multiple arenas. So, for example, health, science, agriculture, the beginning of arms control from the 1960s into the 70s, television and radio broadcasting, and even environmental agreements. These tracks of the relationship were characterized by formal negotiations and then agreements, many of which, and I have a chart of these agreements, I have lots of charts in the report because I think they're useful, were concluded in the year 1972. And I find it interesting that we're still citing those agreements today, actually. If you read the publicity from the Bilateral Commission today, they'll talk about environmental cooperation and they'll say, well, this is based on the precedent of the 1972 Environmental Cooperation Agreement. So obviously, there was some significance to these, but they were nonetheless limited because they were negotiated as traditional treaty agreements are by negotiating officials in limited channels, and they didn't really represent direct collaboration between working officials within ministries or departments. So in the 1980s, we moved into a different phase of the relationship. There was a so-called four-part agenda, and with it, four standing working groups and sub-working groups between foreign ministers or Secretary of State Shultz and Foreign Minister Shevardnadze. And those dealt with basically bilateral issues, arms control, regional conflicts, and human rights. And these were the big issues in the U.S.-Soviet relationship in the 1980s. And by and large, this was an effective relationship. You might say that the ambition in the relationship in the 1980s with the Gorbachev period and Reagan and Gorbachev's relationship shifted from being a breadth in the 1970s of multiple topics where perhaps we could make a little bit of progress to trying to make very deep progress in a few areas, particularly sensitive political areas and arms control. Then with the fall of the Soviet Union, we had really a unique opportunity to reframe how the relationship could be managed. The United States, I think, looked at it primarily as an opportunity to help rebuild the successor countries to the Soviet Union, Russia in particular, into effective, functioning market economies and democratic states. And you had the Freedom Support Act in 1992, which was the vehicle for U.S. assistance to newly independent Russia. Interestingly, as a side note, the first, you know, we're talking today about missile defense cooperation. The first missile defense cooperative working group was actually established under Bush and Yeltsin in 1992, and it didn't really go anywhere. But there was a precedent almost 20 years ago. So into the Clinton years, Clinton and Yeltsin certainly had a rapport. They had a positive working relationship. But both of them, I think importantly, and those advising them recognized that it wasn't enough for the two presidents just to get along and agree at summits about what the relationship should be about. So they created what I will call the first truly comprehensive commission for the U.S.-Russia relationship, and that was later dubbed the Gore-Chernomyrdin Commission, when basically they kicked responsibility to their number two. The commission from the U.S. perspective, as I've described it in the report, was largely about doing due diligence on where our investment in Russian recovery and Russian development was going. We were spending a lot of money on supporting Russia through this aid program, and we wanted to make sure that the money we were spending was being spent appropriately and wisely. Obviously, from the Russian perspective, it served a number of different purposes. There's no question that there were relationships that were built. It was a way of getting around some of the resistances in the bureaucracy, although relative to later efforts, and I'll talk about that, There's no question that there was a lot of show and a lot less go in the Gore-Chernomyrdin Commission, and that was because it was saddled with a kind of bureaucratic structure that was perhaps more reminiscent of a previous era than of the post-Cold War. Just a quick word about the structure, and again, you'll find a nice graphic in here, which I didn't do. But it had 8 working groups. Each of them was headed by a cabinet-level official. So it was very clear, you know, who was the point person on a given issue and what the agenda for that working group was. But in the end, I would say that Gore-Chernomyrdin, on balance, though probably net helpful for the relationship, was not successful as an institution. As I mentioned, the sort of plenary-focused, all-show, big show, bring everyone together, focus on the form rather than the substance was part of it. Part of it was the unilateral nature of our partnership at that point. It's very hard to have a bilateral commission when one side is doing the giving and the other side is doing the receiving, even if that's only the perception. Even if the reality was both sides had something to contribute, it was certainly perceived in that unilateral way. And then, of course, the timing was simply bad. What effectively happened was, by the end of the 1990s, Vice President Gore was running for president, ultimately unsuccessfully, and Prime Minister Chernomyrdin was out. And so as a result, the sort of personal tie that those two leaders had to the commission disappeared, and it was, in a sense, a rudderless ship. So moving into the second Bush administration, President Bush, President George W. Bush, had, I think, kind of a strikingly different, and I would argue, the first genuinely post-Cold War approach to the relationship with Russia, and that was, well, why can't we have a relationship like we have with other regular countries? Why can't we cooperate when it makes sense to cooperate? When we disagree about things, we'll put those things aside, we'll express our disagreements, but we won't be constantly at each other's throats, and we won't feel that this is the single defining relationship as it was during the Cold War. After 9/11, I think, and so Bush attempted to approach the relationship in this way. It was not entirely successful because already early on from the Russian side, there was a feeling that he wasn't listening to Russia's kind of pressing concerns, particularly about the post-Soviet space, about what was going on in the Caucasus, et cetera. But after September 11th, there was a sort of a qualitative change. As we know, then President Putin was the first to call President Bush. There was a real belief, a meeting of the minds, that you know this was an opportunity where there was going to be a single defining challenge. Russia and the United States stood on the same side of that challenge. And so a process that had begun somewhat already was continued, and that was kind of creating a checklist of goals that the United States and Russia were going to work on together. And that was formalized not long afterwards into what was dubbed a strategic dialogue. But unlike the Gore-Chernomyrdin Commission or Schultz-Shevardnadze working groups or the bilateral commission of today, this was an extremely low-profile activity. This was to be handled by the direct private advisors of the presidents, and in fact was handed over to the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, and to Alexander Voloshin in the presidential administration, and they in turn handed it over to their deputies, and in many cases to their deputies. So this happened on a relatively low-profile basis, and the question was it effective? Well, we know that in a few areas it did deliver results. There were some public results. There were some bilateral fora on banking, on energy. But it ran into political obstacles that, quite frankly, neither administration was prepared to solve. One of those on the Russian side was the creation of kind of the vertical of power under Putin. This was a scenario in which, particularly after the first Yukos affair, American businesses, for example, which was one of the big focuses of the Bush administration, were not comfortable engaging with Russia. That was a real obstacle. On the United States side, there was a sort of bureaucratic problem, which is that when various cabinet agencies under the Bush presidency didn't actually follow through on their commitments to this checklist, there wasn't a clear mandate from the White House that they needed to do that. Here are the consequences if you fail, and you know this strategic dialogue that we've created is important to us. So it became a lower and lower priority, and quite frankly, it ultimately disappeared. The part of this story that I haven't really gone into, but that you'll find in the report, is that between each of these different models at different historical points in the relationship, there's been a kind of moment where the new president has decided, well, I know how to do this better than the last guy. And I think that's something interesting that may never go away, quite frankly, in political history. But if you look at the beginning of the Obama administration, I find it interesting that at least there was some attempt to learn from the past. Now, part of it is because a lot of the people who are around were around then, and they knew what went wrong and what went right. But I guess my hope would be, before I describe this current commission, that we can think about this in terms of an institution that maybe, at least now, will outlast a single presidential term and that can be a basis for the relationship going forward indefinitely. So, basic structure of the bilateral presidential commission. 17 working groups, is that still correct? 18 today. You know, on everything from arms control and international security to civil society. It's officially headed by the two presidents. The Secretary of State and the Foreign Minister are the coordinators, and the working groups are typically chaired by cabinet-level officials or other appropriate senior officials with many, many interagency participants. I think in some cases as many as 13 interagency participants, but on the American side, it's typically the State Department and the National Security Council plus whichever sort of relevant cabinet agencies. It's interesting, in terms of lessons from the past, I see this commission, again, in my own opinion, as having drawn two lessons from two very different models. I think from the Gore-Chernomyrdin Commission, this commission has drawn the lesson of not being overly formalistic, not requiring plenary meetings, not requiring an extensive bureaucracy, but rather permitting a lot of flexibility, which is, in a sense, actually what the Bush administration had wanted, that it would be flexible, that it would be something that would just happen without a lot of fanfare. That, of course, didn't happen. What it learned, I think, from the Bush strategic dialogue, the Bush-Putin strategic dialogue, was that there is a need for accountability and there is a need for concrete outcomes. You cannot do a U.S.-Russia relationship management exercise that never produces anything visible. Because when you do that, ultimately, everybody loses their stake in it, and you have to have stakeholders. I would note, as an aside, and we can talk more broadly about the U.S.-Russia relationship, I think one of the things that a commission does is it builds a structure of people who are invested in the relationship where one doesn't otherwise exist. Because let's be quite honest about the U.S.-Russia relationship, there is not a large community in either country that cares about this relationship. I can talk about, you know, Capitol Hill and how it works with many other interest groups, but certainly Russia is not one of them. So I think the focus on concrete outcomes has been very important for this commission. I am not going to do propaganda for the commission and go through every single outcome. I think there's been a good number of them. I'm going to highlight some that I find to be the most interesting. One of them is that last August there was a joint hijacking exercise in the counterterrorism group, where they essentially jointly tracked an airplane, a simulated hijacked airplane, where you had Russian, American, and I think Canadian officers involved. There's been an exchange of information about Islamic finance networks that I think is sort of patently, obviously helpful to both sides in combating terrorism. And I read recently about the creation of a joint, again, U.S., Canada, and Russia training center for counterterrorism at Abramova. Is that right? Mm-hmm. In the counter-narcotics working group, quite famously, in October, there was a joint raid where you literally had Russian and American boots on the ground in the AFPAC border region taking out a heroin drug lab. And we know what a high priority it is for Russia to stop heroin flows from Afghanistan. Clearly, it's a priority for the United States. There was some coordination, as I understand, in the steering group on the crisis in Kyrgyzstan. Obviously, there was no, you know, sort of boots-on-the-ground joint action there, but this is a case where if you compare it, for example, to the dialogue that didn't take place over Georgia, at least we were talking. So I think that's a positive step. The plutonium disposition agreement is being implemented, obviously, from April at long last, and that's in the Nuclear Security Working Group. The Environmental Working Group has produced an agreement to create a joint national park, which makes a lot of sense, between Alaska and the Bering Strait region. And there have been a number of joint studies on Russian sort of natural preserves like Lake Baikal and American like the Everglades and forests around the United States. And then it's almost impossible to list the number of cultural, educational, and sports exchanges there have been, but that has probably been the most active working group bilateral in history. I would note, not everything that's been achieved that you have read about has been under the umbrella of the commission. The New START Treaty, for example, progress on WTO, and the 1-2-3 Agreement, they're all very landmark achievements for the U.S.-Russia relationship and the reset, but they're not commission activities, and we can get into why that is. I think it's, generally speaking, appropriate that that's the case. Areas where there have been perhaps a little less progress, obviously, the Trade and Investment Working Group, this is sort of a persistent problem. There have been some big announcements like the sale of 50 aircraft by Boeing to Russia, Cisco's billion-dollar investment in Skolkovo, but obviously bilateral trade remains extremely low, and part of the reason for that is that we're not really cutting to some of the fundamental issues that inhibit American companies from investing and operating successfully in Russia. And I've heard directly from folks in the corporate world about how frustrating that is, and the Commission is still not able to really fully deal with that issue. There were some major disputes, obviously, over chicken exports in the agriculture working group, as well as the wheat export ban imposed by Russia over the summer. And that has really inhibited progress in other areas, which I'll mention. In the health working group, I think it's gotten a slow start. But basically, there's an enormous distraction in the United States, which is our domestic debate about healthcare. And so, I think it's very hard to ask Health and Human Services in the United States to pay attention to diplomacy when, at the end of the day, they've got bigger fish to fry. The Clean Energy Working Group has for a while lacked concrete projects. I think they're moving more in that direction now. I know that there are some delegations that were exchanged back and forth. I might let Eric talk about that. I think there's a kind of a fundamental problem with working groups that deal with the concept of modernization, which is a major priority of the Medvedev presidential administration, and that is basically that we don't necessarily share the same fundamental understanding of what modernization is. And so I think the challenge remains for the working groups to have a meeting of the minds before they go throwing money and technological investments back and forth. What exactly does modernization mean? Does it take place on a technical level only, on a social level, on a political level? Do all of these things have to happen simultaneously? There is, I will say, as probably one of the few people other than those involved in writing them, who reads most of what the Commission produces, there is a lot of focus on meetings and reports and good intentions. And I don't want to say that this has already gone the way of some of the Gorchir and Amirden working groups, but I think that danger exists, and we have to be careful of it. Obviously, there's always a danger that some crisis will derail everything. Another spy scandal, some kind of conflict in the post-Soviet region. So at the end of the day, we always need more insurance. We need insurance in the form of direct civil society contacts. We need more private sector engagement because, as important as this diverse commission is, government clearly can't do it by itself. I want to note a couple of what I see as kind of theoretical institutional problems or blockages in the commission process. I mentioned I think there is a temptation to go the sort of Gorchir and Amirden direction of a big show. The last major report of the commission, I believe, was 62 pages, so one wonders whether the next one will have to be 63 pages or more in order to be viewed as progress. I mean, this tends to be, quite frankly, the way that bureaucracies operate, and I hope that that doesn't infect the commission. If there's less to report, write less. It seems like a superficial question, but actually it's reflective of how the commission thinks. There's another challenge, which is, to put it quite simply, managing bureaucratic fights and establishing what is a political priority. You only have so much political capital. And so if you're the person coordinating the commission's activities, you have to decide how many times you're going to kick the question all the way up to the presidential level or to someone at the White House or to a senior person at the State Department. You can't do it every time. And so if not every one of the 17 working groups is firing on all cylinders and agreeing to cooperate, some of them you're just going to have to let be. And I think that that's a challenge because it's a kind of admission of defeat, or at least temporary defeat. Obviously, non-diplomats doing diplomacy, that's hard. Even if you send State Department handlers and foreign ministry handlers to sit with them, they can't be there all the time. And I think it's hard for people who are not trained as diplomats to negotiate across the table with one another. And finally, this notion of who owns the ideas, right? Government cannot come up with all the good ideas. And some of the ideas the government comes up with are actively unhelpful. So there has to be substantially more input from the bottom up in the form of civil society and business actually coming up with joint projects. But that tends to be something that's very difficult to kind of weave together. Government decides it has a goal, government meets, and then what? They go back and they say, well, it would be really, really nice if you did this. you know, there has to be funding there, there has to be real long-term support, and that's very hard to do. Basically, you know, I'm not going to, for the interest of time, I'm not going to get deeply into the recommendations that I have in the report. You can read those in the report. I would just point out, I think there are still some sort of overarching challenges for the reset, which will definitely have echo effects on the commission. First is high expectations versus reality. You know, the reality is this is really hard stuff. We've had some landmark agreements like the New START Treaty, which is now actually in force, the 123 agreement, the Afghanistan transit, which is now also formally in agreement. This stuff is not going to happen every couple of months. And I don't think that we should get into the business of trying to portray things that do happen, which are small, as bigger than they are. I think we have to be very honest about where the relationship is, but we have to still be willing to be committed to it, even when we're not achieving big, flashy things every month. I mentioned, I think, you know, some of the low-hanging fruit has been taken care of, areas where we basically have shared interests and not a lot of disagreements. We're going to have to be able now to move into the area where we may have shared interests, but we also have disagreements. And that's what I said, like, about modernization. We have to be able to talk about the areas where we don't see eye to eye. There are still many people on both sides who see this relationship in zero-sum terms. I'm thinking about a quote the other day from Mr. Yakimenko when he was talking about the unrest now in the Arab world, and he said, you know, well, this is the way we would crush unrest. This is something to which Americans react very badly, particularly when it's associated with conspiracy theories about the United States being behind all kinds of revolutions around the world. There's going to be some politics. The Duma elections are coming up in December of this year, and then we have a presidential election cycle in both of our countries in 2012. And the simple fact is, U.S.-Russia cooperation does not sell to voters. It is not something that is going to win votes for anyone on either side. So the best thing we can hope for is for it to be put quietly on the back burner, to continue working effectively, but not to become something that provokes people and actually gets politicized. I mentioned that there are folks on both sides who are not supportive of the relationship and see the world in zero-sum terms. Some of those folks, unfortunately, are in influential bureaucratic positions. And so connect this to what I said earlier about choosing your battles and using your political capital. Sometimes you are going to have to fight people who want to torpedo the relationship. And the more that happens, the more political capital you have to spend. And I can say, at least for the Obama administration, I don't think that it has unlimited political capital after the defeat in 2010 going into a tough presidential election. And then finally, I think this enduring challenge of the lack of people-to-people contacts in this relationship is going to be a real, real problem, which leads me to the conclusion. And that is, I remember something that Mike McFaul once said, and that is that he hopes that this commission is not going to be a one-administration project. He wants to see it sustained until a commission is no longer needed. And I think that's really the question. When we think about what this bilateral commission is doing, whether you think it's window dressing and it's just some name that you put on top of stuff that Americans and Russians do anyway, or you think it is the reason that Americans and Russians do the things that they do together, the real question is going to be, is this something that is going to continue at the same level of activity and the same level of investment, or is it something that as we've seen so many times in the past in the U.S.-Russia relationship, will fall off after a few years and have to be reinvented once again? One step forward, two steps back. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt, for the very interesting presentation. And before I give the floor